You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bores and James Forsyth. So this is the week that the Brady Amendment could be called in Parliament for a vote. James, what are the numbers looking like so far?
So if this amendment is called, and it's not certain it will be, I think it easily has the numbers. First of all, it has the benefit of having lots of people who are experienced in leading rebellions against the government counting up the numbers. And secondly, you know, it had 42 Tory MPs on it when it was first published. There are more coming regularly, and they have a few big names left in the locker to bring out. And I think the point about it is, normally rebellions are drawing on kind of one wing of a party, and so therefore they kind of tap out at some point. You know, there aren't that many more libertarian MPs you can get to. But the point here is, this is drawing support from across the Tory parliamentary party. So you've got, you know, Damian Green, Bob Neil, Harriet Baldwin, Tobias Elwood, Tom Tugendhat, as well as your Steve Bakers, your Philip Davises, and your Esther McVeighs. And I think the point here is that just gives them more numbers. So if Lindsay Hoare calls it, it will pass, because I think you see over the weekend, you know, the Lib Dems are now backing it and Labour and the SNP are moving too, because A, it's easy to justify on a principled stance and the government doesn't help itself, which is the law keeps changing without people realising that these changes are coming into place. This morning, for example, we found that overnight there are some new offences came in, you know, that you can be fined for withholding details of people you've met deliberately from test and trace to prevent them from being told to self-isolate, and you can be fined, for example, for deliberately trying to get your worst enemy forced into self-isolation by naming them. Now, again, these measures are all perfectly sensible, but I think there's a real issue about things becoming criminal offences which people can be fined for without any debate or scrutiny. And I think that one of the things that the government hasn't helped itself on is how last minute some of these legal changes have been. It is hard to claim that this whole current system is functioning well. So that's the kind of principled argument for it. The cynical political argument is, if you have regular votes on these matters, there will be Tory rebellions, and these rebellions will make life difficult for Boris Johnson and will offer the opposition parties a chance to say, don't worry, Prime Minister, we'll support you. And as we discussed on this podcast last week, nothing's more effective at driving a wedge between a Prime Minister and his own party than him relying on opposition votes to get measures through.
Now, Katie, last week when we spoke about this, the government was trying to succumb to some kind of agreement with the rebels about this. Is that happening?
I think there are conversations going on behind the scenes. The Chief Whip is meeting with some Tory MPs today, but I think there is ultimately a slightly unavoidable problem or stop point in this, which is number 10, I think the Chief Whip and others are happy to try and massage the concerns because of MPs and say that we will give you more time to debate these things in the chamber, we will make sure we give you more notice when we're planning changes, but they don't want to give them votes. And I think that all this other stuff is dressing if you're not actually going to be able to have a say. So I think that unless the government change tack and think, actually, we want MPs to be able to vote on the various things, or come up with some way that they're voting on the biggest things. But then as soon as you do that, you get into a distinction of, you know, what counts as a, you know, something that would be worth a vote. Is that a circuit break? Or is that the fact that you wouldn't be allowed to go to another household? Do you know, I think that it starts to run into trouble. So I think that while talks are ongoing and they might lead somewhere, I think that at least for a large number of the people who are, you know, behind this amendment, it's hard to see how much it can go. I think there are a couple of people behind this amendment who are probably softer towards it. I think, as we said previously on the podcast, what's interesting and partly why actually I think it has had such mass support is you can support this amendment and be pro more lockdown restrictions. You can support this amendment and want to take the Swedish approach. All this amendment is saying is MPs should be consulted in decisions and get to approve it. So it means that you do have this mass body. But it's also interesting because it's highlighting, you look at the list, these are all people who have some type of grievance with number 10 at the moment, where that is the actual coronavirus policy, which we know lots of Tory MPs on the libertarian wing do not like because they think it is too restrictive, or whether that is the way that number 10 treats MPs, the sense amongst many MPs that they're not treated with the, you know, the required respect. They are not seen as important players in this. We also had an interesting intervention today, which I've been learning to pronounce the name of in the past 15 minutes, but you've had Steve Baker, former chair of the ERG, so previously causing Theresa May's problems with her Brexit plans, is obviously getting very involved in this rebellion. And he comes from the libertarian wing of the party, but he's given an interview to Times Radio in which he has compared the Prime Minister to Lord of the Rings as a character, which is Theoden. Apparently that's how you say it.
Don't write to us.
If I've got that wrong, do get in touch, but ideally privately, not publicly. And the idea being that this character, as those who've watched the films or read the book will know, is under the spell of their advisors. So I think that you're beginning to see, when you're saying where does this all lead? So Lindsay Coyne might not pick this amendment, but there's lots of discontent, and where does it go? And I think with the Steve Baker thing, you're beginning to see how their anger is starting to move towards questioning the people surrounding Boris Johnson. Now, if Steve Baker, as many think, is referring to Dominic Cummings, this is not the first time Tory MPs have called for Dominic Cummings to go with lit the veil. But I think that this isn't just about, you know, having a say on the restrictions. This is starting to become about other things.
Mm. And James, we keep mentioning that this amendment might not be called. Why might it not be called?
Because it wouldn't have legal force. So essentially, the way this amendment works is, and takes us back to the depths of the kind of Brexit days, the government can't ignore the explicitly stated will of a House, which would be for votes. But this wouldn't be a legal requirement for votes, if you see what I mean. And so John Bercow would undoubtedly have called this amendment. I think Lindsay Hall is hoping not to have to, because he's hoping that the government will back down in advance. And I think that is where things...
There will be an almighty row if he doesn't call it, though.
Yeah, and I think oddly enough, I think some in the government are hoping he won't call it. I mean, in some ways, if it isn't called and the government carries on, that will be the equivalent of, you know, putting your hand on top of the lid of the pot to stop it boiling over. It just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. At some point, it's going to bubble out this anger and this discontent. And I think there is a real problem here, which is, if we are in for another 6 months of this, I think to rule on the most important issue of the day for a year like this is very hard to justify. It's also particularly hard to justify given the steps that have been put in place since March. You know, for example, remote voting in the House of Commons. You know, we are now in a situation where even if you had so many cases of COVID in Parliament that MPs couldn't come into work, they can still vote on legislation and stuff. And also, as Graham Brady has pointed out on Spectator TV last week, and on this podcast indeed, the Civil Contingencies Act already gives the government the power to act immediately. So if it became so concerned by new data showing a rise of infections in London, for example, that it wanted to ban inter-household contact in London immediately, it could do that. It would then just have to get parliamentary approval in short order retrospectively for that change. Now, I think all of those reasons, MPs are not going to be inclined to back down on this one.
Katie, meanwhile, rumours of a London lockdown only get stronger, and of course stricter rules for the north of England as well. Are we heading for even more restrictions very soon?
I mean, we're certainly heading for more restrictions in the next 6 months, and I think it does seem probably sooner rather than later. I think the direction of travel was quite clear last week when Boris Johnson spoke, even though he chose not to go for the more drastic option of a circuit break for various reasons. So I do think one factor was the fact that Tory MPs were so agitated already, particularly with this potential amendment coming up. You want to antagonise, but it's quite clear that, you know, we're going up in terms of the number of restrictions, but I think probably in terms of the public mood, down from here. I think that when you're looking at, I suppose, the pace by which to change restrictions, there had always been this idea that you would have about 2 weeks with every new restriction before you knew what effect it was having. And certainly that was the case initially, but you saw the rule of six. We did not have 2 weeks to work out whether the rule of six was working before things were added to that, so the 10 p.m. curfew. So I think that applying reason to this might not be the right thing to do in terms of like a set schedule. I think that you're hearing a bit when people are talking about restrictions in Scotland, which are a little bit stricter than England, and hear that, you know, in 3 weeks' time there could be a ratcheting up. But I think things can happen a lot quicker, and ultimately it comes down to whether or not they think cases are jumping at such a pace, calls to the 111 number, all these things, that they just make it a quicker decision. I think that the story in the Times today is this idea effectively of a circuit break, so a social lockdown. Not too much joy in this arrangement. The idea being like you can't go to anyone else's house and you can't go to restaurants or pubs, but you should go to work. but you should work from home ideally, but if you can't work from home, you should go to work and you should still go to school. It's kind of, you know, pass go, do not collect your money.
It's like a Chinese parents' idea of the ideal life.
Right, yeah, exactly. So I think that it could happen sooner or later. I do think the thing that's likely to happen first, but these things are fairly fluid, is this idea of banning households from mixing, I think, at least indoors. And I think probably first in people's own residences. So I think one thing that previously has been pushed is the idea you wouldn't be able to go to someone's house, what they have in Scotland, but you could still meet someone in a restaurant or a bar. Now, I think to get to the point where either you can't meet anyone in restaurants and bars, so it's one household, well, that's actually just very damaging to bars and restaurants. I mean, I'm not sure how many people, obviously, I have to be careful what I say in terms of I really enjoy living with my partner, but I think like the idea that we would just go to bars and restaurants alone, you know, weeks on end, I don't think everyone, ultimately people do it to socialise. And then the next step, obviously, is just closing down bars and restaurants, which I think is, again, such a, for at least 2 weeks and see what happens. I think very few people, given what happened last lockdown, thinks that it's just going to be 2 weeks. So I do think that if the government starts to get close to doing that in London, which is the economic, you know, capital of the country as well as just the capital, you're going to start to come up against cabinet opposition again. It's not to say it won't, but you go back to the arguments of the previous week where Rishi Sunak and some other cabinet ministers made their case to Boris Johnson about anything this strict. So it would become a challenge, it would become a juggling of the various arguments.
James?
I think there is a real question about what good this does when the numbers of are 18% and 11% respectively for people either isolating with COVID symptoms or isolating when they're told to do so by a phone call from the test and trace system. And I think as long as those numbers are as low as that, I don't mean to sound like council of despair, but I think you can do all of these things. They're not going to make a difference, right? You look at that study today in The Telegraph, showing only one area that has been in these enhanced local restrictions. Has the policy worked in the stated aim of speedily reducing the infection rate? And I think the problem is people are not following these rules. Now, I mean, that's why the government is talking about massively upping the fines and all this kind of thing. But I mean, the problem is compliance and how can you tell? And also, you know, everyone was much mocked for talking about this at first. I think there is fatigue with all these rules. I think in the first March and April, people were genuinely scared of this virus and people were doing everything they could to show that they were abiding by it. Now, it's now kind of quite clearly different. You know, you don't see, you know, it is not an uncommon sight to see more than six people gathered together. And I think while as in the first lockdown, I mean, when people really were kind of cautious about groups of people and they kind of, even if they were together, they tried to pretend that they weren't. People now are much more open about whether they are following the rules or not. And I think this is a whole challenge, which is, you know, how do you rev people up again to take this seriously? But I think the danger is that the government just ratchets up restrictions when actually trying to find a way to get people to comply with what there is already on the books would be a much more effective way of doing things.
Yeah, and I think just on that, there was some interesting polling over the weekend. I think it was Delta Poll in the Mail on Sunday, which was suggesting only slightly, but now public concern is actually more on the economy and what coronavirus restrictions are going to do that than public health. Now, it was only by a fraction, but I do feel like there is a previously, the economy was almost an afterthought. So I think as things like the furlough scheme are coming to an end, as people are learning how to, you know, live with this virus, which clearly isn't about to go away, there is more of a question of actually, if we close all these things down, like, what is the end game?
And James, meanwhile, tomorrow, the next phase of Brexit negotiations starts. You wrote for The Times last week that a Brexit deal is within touching distance. Are you feeling relatively optimistic?
I think there's cautious but growing optimism in Whitehall that there will be a deal. The two sides, obviously, there are still some tricky issues to be settled. I think one of the things that suggests that you might be able to get there is the trickiest issue is state aid. That is a longer term problem rather than a shorter term one. And so that, you know, that suggests that you might be able to come up with something for now, if you see what I mean on that. I think it's quite clear that the UK side want to get into the tunnel. The Europeans are saying, wait, 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 we're not there yet. You've got to move more beforehand. But I do think that if you compare where things were at the beginning of September, there is clearly is more of a moment now that you might see some progress. I think, you know, the big question is this EU Council on October 15th. Is there enough progress by then for Barnier to say to EU leaders at that meeting, look, what I need to be able to do is offer them this, this, and this, and this, and then I think we can do the deal? Because if there is, if the UK has moved enough for Barnier to basically go to the leaders and say that, then I think you could see that you could get a deal by the end of the month, say, and that would, by the end of October, sorry, and that would give you enough time to get it ratified and on the books.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And you can watch that Graham Brady interview with Andrew Neil on Spectator TV, which is at spectator.co.uk/TV. Or he also spoke to me and James on the Edition podcast last week as well. So thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow.
You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.